This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, I'm Malcolm Bernstein. This is the New Yorker Hour. We start today with, you say you want a revolution. Do you know what you mean by that? It's from the April 1st issue of The New Yorker. There's a note that it's published in the magazine with the title Around and Around, and I think that's a more appropriate title. But there's something in the one I first mentioned. It seems to be mostly about the meaning of the word revolution. The same set of historical episodes might, with equal plausibility, be described from one point of view as representing continuity, and from another as representing radical transformation. In June 2018, the political commentator Fareed Zakaria found himself in the Campo di Fiori in the center of Rome with Steve Bannon, who was then President Trump's chief strategist. Bannon, whom Zakaria describes as a volatile personality, and as a conduit for the international resurgence of nativist sentiment, had come to Italy to help convince two populist parties, one on the left and the other on the right, that their interests were aligned. He drew Zakaria's attention to a monument to Giordano Bruno, the 16th century poet and cosmologist who held Copernican views about the universe and was burned at the stake for heresy. Where Galileo sold out and recanted, Bannon explained, Bruno was a real hero. Zakaria was surprised by Bannon's admiration for Bruno, who was widely regarded as a progressive, proto-Enlightenment figure. But Bannon was less interested in the substance of Bruno's opinions than in his uncompromising defiance. It was Bruno's conviction, Zakaria writes, that in terms of turmoil, take no prisoners, radicalism is the only option. In his new book, Age of Revolutions, Progress and Backlash from 1600 to the Present, published by Norton, Zakaria concedes the turmoil but resists the radicalism. Everywhere you look, he says, you can see dramatic change. The rules-based international order has been destabilized. Traditional left-right divides have been transfigured. The trade-friendly economic consensus of the post-communist era has yielded to protectionism and autarky. Given that we may be living through one of the most revolutionary ages in history, he thinks that lessons can be drawn from previous revolutionary ages, especially those that involved actual revolutions. The concept of revolution, Zakaria notes, is a slippery thing. How is it that Bannon, of all people, identifies himself as a revolutionary? Zakaria finds the problem embedded in the word itself. Revolution was originally employed to describe the orbital movement of a celestial body around a fixed axis. A full revolution is completed by returning to a starting point. But before long, the word acquired a secondary meaning, designating a rupture that renders everything utterly different. The word now refers at once to predictability and to transformation. Revolution is hardly the only word that contains its opposite, to sanction and to dust or similar in that way. But in this particular case, Zakaria sees something profound. Revolutions contain the seeds of their own doing. He says, radical advance is followed by backlash and a yearning for a past golden age imagined as simple, ordered, and pure. Taken to its logical conclusion, this idea would represent a cyclical idea of history, a fatalist notion that has recently found favor among conservatives. Zakaria believes that we can and do make progress. But he's wary of the assumption that history tends to move in the direction of ever greater human flourishing, a Whiggish view he associates with such frustrated optimists as Steven Pinker. Zakaria's book represents an attempt to distinguish between revolutions that have inspired thermostatic reactions and revolutions that have endured. The most auspicious model, Zachariah suggests, might be found in the Netherlands and in England. In the 16th century, all of Europe was confronted by a series of economic, technological, and social shocks. The globalization spurred by the age of exploration, the innovations that emerged from war and from the necessity of economic expansion, and a radical identity revolution driven by the Protestant Reformation. After most of the Netherlands threw off the Habsburg rule in 1579, the Dutch formed a republic that capitalized on these changes. For reasons of geography, they were accustomed to diffuse authority. The need to reclaim land from the sea and the collective action required to do so, Zachariah explains, had ensured that feudal centralization never took hold. He said people had to work together to get anything done. Technological development in the form of windmills and dikes was a necessity for survival, and precocious urbanization provided an infrastructure for industry and trade. The cultural shift to Protestantism encouraged free thinking. Finance was democratized in the form of the world's first stock exchange, and the leaders of the Republic were wise enough to ally themselves with the country's commercial interests. The Netherlands might have been early to liberalize, but that didn't mean it was exempt from what Zachariah describes as the familiar story of reaction. At rapid advancement, dislocation, then a wave of conjured memories of a lost golden age. The Dutch Republic was split between the economic dynamism of tolerant coastal technocrats and the atavistic impulses of more conservative rural populations that had been left behind by liberal merchants and bankers. The country's golden age came to an end in 1672 when the French invaded. A version of liberalism, in the form of a young William of Orange, nevertheless survived and, 16 years later, was ported across the Channel to lead a constitutional monarchy. England, like the Netherlands, was prepared to make a seamless transition to a liberal dispensation. The brilliance of England's glorious revolution, Zachariah thinks, lay in the collaboration of the country's Whig and Tory elites in a bipartisan escape from dangerous polarization, and in their agreement that English prosperity defined the national interest, not dynastic glory or religious zeal. A good revolution, as Zachariah tells it, is not initiated by political actors. It occurs when exogenous shocks in the form of economic or technological trends are tamed by competent management. Liberalism flourished in the Netherlands and England because revolution was a bottom-up process in those countries. When Dutch and English leaders saw fit to intervene in the course of human affairs, they were content merely to implement, confirm, and codify the transformations that had already taken place in society beneath the surface of politics. These revolutions succeeded insofar as they were scarcely needed. A good revolution respects the limits of natural forces. A bad revolution crosses a line and provokes the backlash necessary to maintain equilibrium. Zachariah's counterexample to the Netherlands and England is France, whose revolution was a grisly failure insofar as revolutionary elites tried to impose modernity and enlightenment by top-down decree on a country that was largely unready for it. The Reign of Terror and the consolidation of power under Napoleon, Zachariah says, prove that social change must take place organically. Zachariah's descriptions of revolutionary activity make a great din. When things aren't plunging or soaring, they have skyrocketed or ricocheted. But his evocations of historical inflection points feel dutiful and formulaic. They're also confusing. After a while, one can't help but wonder what Zachariah means by revolution. What he calls the Dutch Revolution seems to refer to the entirety of the country's golden age, which lasted about 90 years and ended with the Republic's abrupt decline. We're invited with fine illogic to compare the success of the Industrial Revolution with the failure of the French Revolution, even though a failed Industrial Revolution would be no Industrial Revolution at all. He identifies the English Revolution with the Glorious Revolution, treating decades of bloodletting and repression as mere prelude to a crowning moment of liberal reconciliation. By this reasoning, one might claim that the Russian Revolution culminated in Glasnost. Nor is it clear what Zachariah means by top-down or bottom-up. The French Revolution failed because the elites tried to force top-down change, but the Glorious Revolution, which might better be described as a coup by Dutch commercial interests, somehow reflected a wise acquiescence to the bottom-up processes. The specifics of revolutionary activity seem of secondary interest. Zachariah takes solace in the fact that civilization seems able to heal itself. The revolutions of 1848, for example, may have been crushed by societies mired in primordial autocracy, but everything that they hoped to enact, the proliferation of human freedoms, was almost invariably adopted through gradual reform. The implication is that what the vanguard struggled to achieve by fiat was going to happen anyway. All they had to do was sit tight. Most revolutions have, at one point or another, had their revolutionary credentials challenged. Events that purportedly failed to rise to the radical occasion include the English Revolution, merely a bid for bourgeois power, skeptics say. The Mexican Revolution, a rivalry between warlords, and even the French Revolution. The American Revolution is a recurring example. At the time, it seemed as though an awful lot changed after 1776. In retrospect, many things, in fact, remained the same. Some historians have introduced further distinctions without introducing further clarity. The colonists' struggle against the British, it has been suggested, qualified as a political revolution, but did not meet the criteria for a social revolution. This, however, is just a restatement of the observation that the same set of historical episodes might, with equal plausibility, be described from one point of view as continuous and from another as a break. The word revolution may be perfectly useful as a complement we pay to inflection points for developments that are, by consequence, important. But the attempt to provide a load-bearing definition might be more trouble than it's worth. In The Age of Revolutions and the Generations Who Made It, published by BASIC, Nathan Pearl Rosenthal, a professor of history at the University of Southern California, offers what he calls an anti-exceptionalist history of the Age of Revolution. In his view, there's an alternative way to understand why the great transatlantic revolutions that straddled the turn of the 19th century in the United States, France, Haiti, and Latin America are often said to have failed. Unlike Zachariah, Pearl Rosenthal doesn't really believe that counter-revolutionary or illiberal reversals prove that the early revolutionaries were overweening. He argues instead that the degree to which these revolutions met or did not meet their egalitarian aims should be understood in the light of processes that took a full generation to unfold. In 1972, Henry Kissinger asked the Chinese premier, Zhou Enlai, what he thought of the French Revolution. Zhou is said to have responded that it was too early to tell. The story apparently turns on a miscommunication. Zhou was probably referring to the events of 1968 rather than those of 1789, but it persists for a reason. Pearl Rosenthal doesn't go that far, but like a professor who generously grants extensions before grading, he thinks that revolutionary fervor can be assessed only as the spark of a longer undertaking. Pearl Rosenthal's book follows several members of what he calls the first generation of gentlemen revolutionaries. His cast includes famous political actors such as John Adams, less well-known but influential women such as Maria Rivadeneira, a prioress in Peru, and Marie Bunel, a merchant in Haiti, and more run-of-the-mill figures like Francis Louis Augustin Bosque, now best known for the pears that bear his name. Perry Rosenthal believes that these figures had considerable difficulties overcoming the hierarchical reflexes of the mid-18th century Atlantic old regime in which they'd grown up. Theirs was a largely closed world of intimate relationships and norms opaque to outsiders. Their social attitudes made it difficult for them to forge alliances beyond their station. Take Rivadeneira, who presided over a convent in Cuzco, Peru, in the last quarter of the 18th century. Her ancestors had come to South America with Francisco Pizarro, and she was raised in luxury as part of the imperial colony's Criollo elite. She liked ballads sung from balconies and farces performed in the evenings. Her skirts were inlaid with mother-of-pearl medallions, and she took chocolate for breakfast. In 1780, a member of the native nobility, Tupac Amaru, launched a revolt against the Spanish. At the time, Pearl Rosenthal notes, it was easy to imagine that the interests of the natives and those of the Criollos might be united against an extractive empire. Rivadeneira herself seems to have considered the possibility of such an alliance. In the end, however, she and her family led a defense of Cuzco that turned the war against Amaru, who was executed. Rivadeneira, like other figures of Pearl Rosenthal's first revolutionary generation, never lost sight of the interests of her caste. But even if she had given freer rein to her sympathy with the rebellious natives, Pearl Rosenthal argues, the two worlds were simply too far apart for such a political confederation to be realized. Hereditary inequality was too great. The coalitions that did emerge were held together weakly by the mere argument among individuals that what they wanted was not this, or they arose by default. The wealthiest people were risk-averse because they had a lot to lose. The poorest people were risk-averse because they couldn't afford to lose the little they had. Insurrectionary outbreaks were thus almost random. Pearl Rosenthal takes as one example the storming of the Bastille. He writes, "The working classes in Paris, conditioned by decades of increasingly separate living, had a remarkable capacity for self-organizing, yet the same social realities that had made them effective self-organizers also defined the horizon of their political vision. The dark, crenellated fortress of the Bastille seemed like a reasonable target. It just looked like a place that deserved storming. And it was, if only symbolically, which is why we remember it. As a strategic objective, however, the Bastille, which housed nothing of royal or military importance, left something to be desired. The crowd's unfamiliarity with which sanctum actually mattered, Pearl Rosenthal says, spurred action against places and people who did not, in fact, have much power to meet their demands. This miscalculation wasn't the protesters' fault. They had no way to obtain the right information or develop the proper alliances. In Pearl Rosenthal's telling, the revolutions on the other side of the Atlantic followed a similar script. The social stratification of the pre-revolutionary era in each case provided little room for egalitarianism. The United States Constitution was the product of a successful revolution from above, he writes. The Constitutional Convention was itself a virtual coup by the elite against the existing government. Something comparable happened in Haiti. Toussaint Louverture, the leader of the Haitian Revolution, was born into slavery, but even as a freed man, he remained a product of a hierarchical world. Although this revolution had begun as a revolt from below, Louverture tried to transform it into a revolution from above, falling into what one recent biographer has described as an authoritarian spiral. In his attempts to protect the nascent country's independence, he was perfectly willing to send the masses back to their plantations in a condition of near bondage. Elites acted this way because they were certain that only they could know what was best for everyone. But this was a generational limitation, and it eroded with time. If such men as John Adams and Toussaint Louverture could only imagine rearranging the game pieces, Pearl Rosenthal says, they nevertheless enabled their successors to upend the board. He writes, they had managed to irretrievably fracture the old regime. Out of the disarray, new people and new kinds of politics were beginning to emerge. As classes started to mix, movements became broader and more heterogeneous. When the United States Capitol moved to Washington, D.C., elected officials and other elites had no choice but to room and drink with men of the lower orders. In the provinces, the 1790s saw the coalescence of the Republican Party, which took shape as a mass organization that united elite and working-class voters. Drinking together led to durable institutions that advanced more equitable forms of mobilization, expanding the franchise and political participation more generally, beyond property owners. In Latin America, solidarity movements succeeded in an extended campaign for independence from the Spanish crown, though, as Pearl Rosenthal notes, the revolutionary results frequently assumed an illiberal cast. In Haiti, the militarized coercion of the Louverture era and its immediate successors coalesced into a pattern of one-man rule, even as the country's development was hamstrung by punitive foreign debts. As a piece of scholarship, Pearl Rosenthal's book is a persuasive and inspired contribution to perennial historical debates. Was the American Revolution a project of radical egalitarianism, or was it simply a transfer of elite power? Was the French Revolution stymied by external forces of reaction, or was it fundamentally illiberal to begin with? His response is that we should not limit our gaze to supposedly sharp turning points and dramatic transformations, but instead narrate the past as a series of successive and intertwined campaigns to improve our estate. Pearl Rosenthal's book is written for a general readership, and he makes the further case that the stakes of this enterprise extend beyond those of scholarship. He writes, buying into this fantasy of instantaneous revolution has significant consequences, most damagingly, a potential loss of faith in the possibilities of change if the transformation fails to arrive as quickly as expected. It's little wonder that our current political climate, in which the stagnation and senescence at the top can feel disconnected from agitation and ferment below, has called forth treatises on revolutionary ages. Electrifying visions of the future seem in short supply. As the writer and historian Steve Fraser put it in a recent essay for the magazine Jacobin, the right and the left have settled on competing calls not for revolution, but for restoration. Both Zachariah and Pearl Rosenthal want to shore up our faith in transformative incrementalism, the idea that we might extricate ourselves from this mess by putting one foot in front of the other. Zachariah's book concludes that revolutions fail when they're visited on societies that are unprepared to adapt to new conditions. He has little to say about what kinds of outcomes might be desirable, but much to say about what we should not do. He's very concerned about the rise of identity politics. Although he opens his book with the Bannon anecdote, he implies that men like Bannon aren't worth worrying about and are best seen as a reaction engendered by an overreaching left. A fixation on contemporary identity politics helps explain his assessment of revolutionary precedents. The Glorious Revolution was good because the conservative and liberal elites at the time agreed to stop harping on religious differences and focus instead on economic commonalities. Their French counterparts a century later failed to heed this lesson. The Reign of Terror, he says, shows how appeals to exclusive categories of identity can easily get out of control. When everyone is either a patriot or a traitor, heads will roll. Technological lurches, such as the rise of artificial intelligence, are scary, but the social order can be preserved, and the pendular threat of backlash staved off, as long as politicians do not use identity to pander to anxious constituencies. Zachariah says, where politics was once overwhelmingly shaped by economics, politics today is being transformed by identity. This may be an untenable distinction. Economic interests are not simply waiting to be revealed. They're mediated through social identity, and that's true even of political groups defined overtly through economic relations. As the historian E.P. Thompson puts it, the working class made itself as much as it was made. If economics directly shaped politics, people like Maria Rivadeneira would have allied themselves with the natives against the Spanish. Those common interests had to be constructed, made socially legible, through a process of trial and error. In this respect, Pearl Rosenthal's book can be taken as a story of how novel forms of solidarity became available to a post-revolutionary generation. The new cohort was no longer enthralled to the old regime's social structure. When the first generation broke, in his account, the second generation was able to piece back together more deliberately. An abatement of inequality created the occasion to gather and make trade-offs. These trade-offs required sustained personal interactions among heterogeneous groups that scarcely existed in an earlier era, further reducing inequality. This was not a matter of giving up on identity politics, but a matter of reshuffling and expanding the kinds of identities that mattered. Pearl Rosenthal suggests that, in the early decades of the United States, the Republican Party afforded a mechanism for a more capacious national self-interest, one that could encompass both elites and commoners. With the tumult of the American Revolution behind them, the longing for freedom in theory gave way to the administration of particular freedoms in practice. Those freedoms were, needless to say, unevenly distributed, which is one of the reasons that some critics have written off the American Revolution. At the end of Pearl Rosenthal's introduction, he suggests that his anti-exceptionalist story of revolutions might put to rest the notion that the American Revolution was distinctively tainted by the Patriot movement's imbrication with slavery and racism. His primary reference here seems to be the Times Magazine 1619 Project, with its charge that the putative egalitarianism of the framers was little more than a lie. What this interpretation leaves out, according to Pearl Rosenthal, is that all the transatlantic revolutions began to unfold at an accelerating pace as the initial revolutionary vanguard was swept aside. By our lights, it is monstrous that this branching egalitarianism remained racist and exclusionary, and that freedom for some entailed the perpetuation of violent bondage for others. But there was nothing singular about this compromise. After all, Haiti freed the enslaved but maintained a system of plantation agriculture that was virtually indistinguishable from slavery. Contemporary activists on the left like to quote Emma Lazarus and Maya Angelou to the effect that none of us are free until all of us are free. This is lovely as an aspirational ideal and powerful as an exhortation, but it should not be mistaken for an empirical claim. Pearl Rosenthal's book shows in detail how some people achieved a measure of freedom while others remained in chains. The we of We the People represented an expansion of the circle of moral concern. It took and will take a lot more work to expand that circle further. If we act in good faith to reckon in this way with the pervasive illiberalism of the revolutionary era, Pearl Rosenthal offers, this discussion might point to an exit from today's heated debates about the rot at the core of our nation's founding. It could replace the low hum of mutual suspicion and the fantasy that a true revolution can come only at the hands of the morally pure, with a renewed commitment to the unglamorous work of political organization. His emphasis on the logistics of solidarity reminds us that moral advances are neither a salutary byproduct of economics or technology, as Zachariah seems to think, nor a matter of progressive inevitability. Still, the analytic edge of Pearl Rosenthal's account, like Zachariah's, is blunted by its central historical category. The concept of revolution, especially in contrast to mere reform, conveys an exhilaration that's hard to relinquish. Yet it's worrying when an argument places weight, as Zacharias does, on an honorific that encompasses both the removal of Louis XVI and the wide adoption of steam power. Pearl Rosenthal does his best to preserve something productive in the idea of a grand event that requires a generational shift to fructify. But this scheme, he seems to concede, makes much more sense in the case of the United States than it ever did in Peru or in Haiti. The halting progress he describes so well could just as easily be portrayed as the result of distinct campaigns, rather than as belated aspects of a dramatic and all-encompassing movement. Perhaps the most revolutionary step we could take would be to relax our grip on revolution itself. This by Gideon Lewis Krause, the staff writer at The New Yorker. He's the author of the memoir, A Sense of Direction. We all know too well what happens and does not in our country when there's a mass shooting, but I was not prepared for news of Russia after the attack at the Moscow Theater last week. The article from TheNewYorker.com on March 24th is partially answered already, but the question raised will resound for a while. The caption is, "How will Putin respond to the terrorist attack in Moscow?" On last Friday night, at least four men stormed Crocus City Hall, a concert venue in Moscow's northwest outskirts, gunning down victims as they ran screaming through the building's cavernous foyer. Those trapped inside captured the grim scene on their cell phones, assailants fanning out with weapons drawn, bursts of automatic gunfire, bodies slumped on the floor. The attackers set fire to the auditorium, a blaze that spread quickly. Smoke and flames engulfed the building. According to a telegram channel close to Russian law enforcement, police found 28 bodies in a single bathroom. Another 14 were recovered in an emergency stairwell. In total, 137 people are dead, the most killed by an active terror in Russia since 2004, when more than 300 people were killed after militants seized a school in Beslan. The act of terror was, above all, exactly that, a ghoulish spasm of violence reminiscent of the worst attacks in Europe in recent years, such as the storming of the Bataclan Theater in Paris in 2015, where 130 people were killed. But in Russia, after 24 years of Vladimir Putin's rule, He just extended his reign by another 6 years in elections last week, and 2 years into its war with Ukraine, the attack may carry its own political significance. Lapses in security can be especially problematic for would-be strongmen. After all, Putin's implicit appeal to the Russian people rests on the very idea of a muscular, unified, well-resourced state capable of protecting them. He began his rise to power on the back of a brutal counterinsurgency campaign in Chechnya, and now implores the nation not only to rally around the conflict with Ukraine, but to participate in what he presents as an era-defining struggle against a collective West intent on Russia's destruction. Friday night's attack is an awful and uncomfortable swerve from that narrative. Within hours, an ISIS affiliate known as ISIS-K, the K stands for Khorasan Province, a reference to Afghanistan and other parts of Central Asia, claimed that its fighters were responsible for killing and wounding hundreds and causing great destruction to the place before they withdrew to their bases safely. ISIS-K, which has carried out terror attacks in Afghanistan and Iran, has long targeted Russia in its rhetoric, citing the Kremlin's extensive bombing campaign in Syria and its fight against militants in the Muslim-majority Russian republics in the North Caucasus. Earlier this month, Russian security services killed two men who, officials said, were planning to carry out an attack on a Moscow synagogue on behalf of ISIS-K. Over the weekend, ISIS-affiliated social media channels released gruesome body cam footage which shows the terrorists firing at people inside the hall. One of them approaches a wounded man lying on the ground and slits his throat with a knife. A voice yells, "Kill them! Show no mercy!" and "The infidels will be defeated!" The attack appeared to fit with a scenario U.S. intelligence agencies had been warning about for weeks. In early March, the U.S. Embassy in Russia said it was monitoring reports that extremists have imminent plans to target large gatherings in Moscow, including concerts. On Friday, Adrian Watson, a spokesman for the National Security Council, confirmed the existence of such intelligence, adding that the U.S. government also shared this information with Russian authorities in accordance with its long-standing duty-to-warn policy. Putin, however, seems to have dismissed this alert as a ruse or a provocation. At a meeting with top FSB officials just 3 days before the terror attack, Putin addressed the intelligence warnings from Western governments. He said, "All this resembles outright blackmail and the intention to intimidate and destabilize our society." In his remarks to the FSB, Putin was much more focused on the war in Ukraine, which he referred to as the most critical and intense aspect of your work today, undoubtedly related to the special military operation. And he linked any mention of the terrorist threats to efforts by the West to weaken Russia, saying, "The same Western special services which are behind their manifestations." A horrific and in some ways predictable ISIS attack that shatters a sense of security in Russia's capital does not fit with Putin's political obsessions. Members of Russia's vast security apparatus are first and foremost agents of regime protection. The Islamic State is included on the country's register of terrorist and extremist organizations, but so is the political network of Alexei Navalny, who died in a Russian prison last month. On Friday, the day of the attack, the Kremlin added what it vaguely referred to as the worldwide LGBT movement to the same list. In February, a report by the investigative news site Prokht, which the Russian state has deemed undesirable, counted 10,000 people who faced criminal prosecution in politically motivated cases in the course of Putin's current six-year presidential term, surpassing the comparable figures under the Soviet leaders Nikita Khrushchev and Leonid Brezhnev. Ruslan Leviev, an open-source researcher who was convicted in absentia for his coverage of Russian military operations and is now based in the U.S., remarked, "In a country where counter-terrorist special forces are chasing commentators from the Internet who said something wrong about Putin or wrote about Bucha, terrorists will always feel free." Unsurprisingly, Putin has tried to connect what, by all accounts, is an act of ISIS terror to Ukraine. In a nationwide address on Saturday, he spoke of a horrific and savage act of terrorism, but never mentioned by name the actual group, ISIS, that had claimed responsibility. "They attempted to escape and were headed toward Ukraine," he said of the four suspects, adding that a window was prepared for them on the Ukrainian side to cross the state border. An FSB statement said that the suspects had appropriate contacts in Ukraine. Medusa, an independent Russian outlet, reported that the Kremlin had instructed state media to emphasize traces of Ukrainian involvement in the attack. It has become fashionable to label every attack inside Russia as a false flag, a decoy operation launched by Russia's security services. Ukraine's own military intelligence agency went for this theory, calling Friday's attack a planned and deliberate provocation by the Russian special services at the behest of Putin. There is compelling, if far from conclusive, evidence of involvement by the FSB in a series of apartment bombings in 1999 that paved the way for Putin to become president. But in the years since, the truth is often more banal. The Putin state directs incredible resources to and has become quite proficient at protecting itself, but is less capable, perhaps even less interested, in protecting those over whom it rules. As for what Putin does now, the 2004 terrorist attack in Beslan may be instructive. In the aftermath of that tragedy, Putin moved not to reform Russia's security agencies, for example, or to hold an independent inquiry on the security forces' decision to fire heavy explosives at the school, but rather to roll back nascent democratic reforms. The Kremlin canceled direct elections of regional governors in favor of presidential appointments. It also abolished single-mandate districts in the Duma, removing the last independent voices in parliament. All of which is to say, an attack does not have to be a planned provocation for Putin to look to spin it to his political advantage. Still, it's hard to imagine the Kremlin doing more to empower the FSB in its hunt for enemies, real or imagined, or to further erode Russia's democratic institutions. Similarly, can Russia realistically escalate its attacks on Ukraine cities and civilian infrastructure, given that on Friday, hours before the terror attack, dozens of Russian missile and drone strikes hit energy facilities across the country? Putin could instead try to have Russians forget about the horrors at Crocus City Hall, or at least move on without much fanfare, lest they arrive at difficult questions for him and the state. Or he may attempt, as he did in the first hours after the attack, to replace the prospect of real evil with a more suitable enemy. Wartime creates its own logic of expediency. The same is true for late-stage autocracies obsessed with their survival. Putin, then, may well indeed find a response to the massacre, even if it has little to do with those who carried it out. This report by Joshua Yaffa, a contributing writer at The New Yorker, and the author of Between Two Fires, Truth, Ambition, and Compromise in Putin's Russia, which won the Orwell Prize in 2021. And now to a major economic story with roots right here in Cincinnati. Business and politics. From the comment page at thenewyorker.com on March 25th, why the Biden administration is suing Apple and investigating big grocers. The Department of Justice's antitrust division made headlines last week by suing Apple and accusing the company of monopolizing the smartphone market and its associated services. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland, at a public briefing in Washington, said the iPhone maker has maintained its power not because of its superiority, but because of its unlawful exclusionary behavior. Meanwhile, in a move that has received less attention, the staff of the Federal Trade Commission, the other big agency entrusted with enforcing competition laws, released a lengthy report on another increasingly concentrated part of the economy, the grocery industry. The FTC report said that some big food and beverage retailers exploited the supply chain disruptions associated with the COVID-19 pandemic to squeeze their suppliers and further hike prices to increase their profits. In a statement accompanying the release of the report, Lena Khan, the FTC's chair, said that dominant retailers used this moment to come out ahead at the expense of their competitors and the communities they serve. Khan and Jonathan Cantor, who's the head of the DOJ's antitrust division, are the leaders of the Biden administration's effort to confront big businesses that it claims are exploiting their market power to enrich themselves to the detriment of their clients and the market as a whole. The campaign has sometimes been a rocky one. The antitrust agencies have lost some big court cases, including an effort to block Microsoft from taking over the game maker Activision Blizzard, but they've successfully scuttled a number of deals, such as the takeover of the book publisher Simon & Schuster by Penguin Random House and a tie-up between American Airlines and JetBlue. In any case, an aggressive antitrust policy has become one of the defining features of this administration, and it will surely continue if Joe Biden gets reelected. After Biden was elected president in 2020, he nominated Khan, Cantor, and others associated with a new antitrust movement that traces its roots to Louis Brandeis, the early 20th century trespasser and Supreme Court justice. Biden also set up the White House Competition Council, which includes officials from many different government agencies. Although the president was hardly known as a scourge of corporations, he sounded some distinctly Brandeisian themes, declaring in July 2021, "Capitalism without competition isn't capitalism, it's exploitation." Lately, he's been criticizing big corporations for price gouging, imposing junk fees, and shrinking the size of their products while maintaining prices, a phenomenon known as shrinkflation. The revival of antitrust enforcement efforts goes well beyond the issue of whether Snickers bars have shrunk. After Biden suggested in his State of the Union address that they had gotten smaller, Mars, the maker of the caramel peanut bars, issued a statement denying it. Cantor, Khan, and their allies are basically claiming that rising monopoly power is a serious problem in many different parts of the economy, not just the technology sector, and that across the country's courts and policymakers need to address it aggressively across the board. The DOJ's Apple lawsuit and the FTC's report on the grocery industry illustrate many of the issues at stake. At last week's press conference, Cantor compared the government's case against Apple to three famous anti-monopoly cases from the past: Standard Oil, AT&T, and Microsoft. During Bill Clinton's presidency, the Justice Department brought the Microsoft case in 1998, accusing the software giant of exploiting its grip on the operating system market to create a stranglehold for web browsers by forcing computer makers to bundle Internet Explorer on its devices. The government argued that this tactic deprived customers of choices and stifled innovation. In the Apple case, the Justice Department is making a similar argument, claiming that Apple used technology restraints and restrictive contracts to keep smartphone users and application developers confined within its proprietary ecosystem, where it can charge high prices and fees. Cantor said, "Today, we stand here once again to protect competition and innovation for the next generation of technology." The Justice Department's complaint, which referenced internal communications from Apple that were subpoenaed, detailed a number of tactics the company allegedly used to bolster and maintain its monopoly power. These included restricting the ability of iPhone users to download cloud-based games, refusing to integrate other text messaging apps with its own iMessage system, and blocking super apps that would allow iPhone users to carry out a number of online activities, such as shopping, exchanging payments, and chatting from within one application. The complaint also said that Apple executives were concerned that if iPhone users downloaded a super app, it would be easier for them to switch to cheaper smartphones. The lawsuit quoted one Apple manager as saying that allowing super apps would be letting the barbarians in at the gate. The corporate behavior detailed in the FTC report had less to do with technology innovation and more to do with sheer size. Between 1990 and 2019, the report noted, the four biggest grocers have increased their combined market share from 15% to more than 30%. The report was based on information from three grocery retailers, Kroger, Walmart, and Amazon, three large food wholesalers, Associated Wholesale Grocers, C&S Wholesale Grocers, and McLane Company, and three big food producers, Kraft Heinz, Tyson Foods, and Procter & Gamble. During the panic, as the big retailers experienced significant shortages and increases in the cost of goods they sold, they used their size to pressure suppliers to favor them over smaller competitors for deliveries and also raise their prices to cover their extra costs, the report said. Hiking their prices was a perfectly legitimate reaction, but the report presents prima facie evidence that the grocers went beyond simply recuperating rising costs. As they raised their prices, their profit margins, the difference between total revenues and total costs, reached 6% in 2021, compared to 5.6% in 2015, and then rose further to 7% in the first 9 months of 2023, when the rate of inflation was already coming down. The report said the profit trend cast doubt on assertions that rising prices at the grocery store are simply moving in lockstep with retailers' own rising costs. It also called on the full commission and Congress to look into the issue. Apple, in a public statement, said the Justice Department's lawsuit threatens who we are, and if successful, would set a dangerous precedent, empowering government to take a heavy hand in designing people's technology. Reacting to the FTC report, the National Grocers Association, which represents independent grocers, said it confirmed that national chains, or so-called power buyers, are abusing their immense economic power to the detriment of competition and American consumers. Amazon and Walmart did not answer requests for comment. A spokesman for Kroger said in an email that the retailer had not responded publicly to the report. Kroger is currently trying to get bigger by merging with rival chain Albertsons, but last month the FTC sued to block that deal. Given the glacial pace at which antitrust cases move through the courts, The Apple lawsuit likely won't be resolved until the next presidency. The Justice Department case that led to the breakup of AT&T lasted 8 years, and the Microsoft case took about 3.5 years until settlement was reached. Time isn't the biggest challenge facing the Justice Department and FTC, though. It's that the U.S. court system, in the course of the past half century, many justices have applied a strict consumer welfare standard to antitrust cases, which in practice means the government has to show that a certain corporate action or merger either led to higher prices or is likely to lead to them. In the high-tech industry, particularly, where many apps and services are distributed at zero price, this standard is often difficult to apply. The courts, including the Supreme Court, in the 2004 Trinco case, have also adopted a skeptical attitude to claims that companies should be obligated to do business with potential competitors. The United States antitrust laws date to the Sherman Act of 1890 and the Clayton Act of 1914. In many cases, such as those relating to price fixing and other blatantly anti-competitive agreements, or tying requirements of the sort employed by Microsoft with its Internet Explorer browser, these laws are adequate for the task. But they weren't designed for the digital age, and there's a clear need to update them for the 21st century. In recent years, the European Union has gone at least some way to show how this could be done, introducing a Digital Markets Act and a Digital Services Act, which laid down new guidelines for dominant players, including rules designed to make their platforms more open to app designers and other companies. Considering the gridlock on Capitol Hill, there is little immediate prospect of similar legislation in the United States. In this challenging environment, the new trustbusters would have little option but to plow ahead and make their cases in the courts of justice and public opinion. That's what they are doing. This by John Cassidy, staff writer at The New Yorker since 1995. He also writes a column about politics, economics, and more for TheNewYorker.com. And that's all we have time for today. I'm Malcolm Bernstein. This has been The New Yorker Hour. I'll be back with you again next week. Till then, take care, stay safe, and be well. Bye-bye.